Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Ramadan is beginning for the world's Muslims. The month-long observance is a time to fast, to think, and to spend time with friends and family. In the United States, people of different national origins gather at Islamic centers for religious services and to celebrate their beliefs. Muslim Americans observe Ramadan in much the same way as Muslims in other countries do. There are traditions to be followed. Families buy meat prepared according to Muslim law. The meat is served after sunset, when the daily fast ends. Fasting requires Muslims to avoid eating, drinking, and sexual activity during daylight hours. Families also pray together and help the poor. Shakir el-Sayed is the religious leader of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia. The center serves Muslims of 42 different nationalities. He said, "Ramadan becomes a very helpful opportunity to bring people together, those who come from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds." He added, "We all speak English, so we use English as a unifying language, and at the same time, we do all the activities to accommodate everybody, especially in Ramadan." Shakir said, "The center provides Muslims free meals to break their fast. It also organizes nightly prayers during Ramadan. During the day, Muslim Americans are fasting, but their co-workers and friends are not." For Ibrahim Radi, an Egyptian American, that is not a problem. "I have to fast because it is my religious duty," he said, so it does not concern him too much. His wife Nadia told VOA she misses big family gatherings in Morocco. "There is a big difference. Here you do not have extended families, so instead of having 10 people around the table, there is only the two of us," she said. Some Muslim Americans say their workday seems longer because they have to carry out their religious duties during Ramadan. Amina Tanbush of Senegal describes some of those duties. "Everyone will cook some food and bring it, and we all eat together and pray together, and we talk about the Muslim religion, teach each other. Sometimes we go to pray together around lunchtime," she said. For many Muslim American groups, Ramadan also is a time to tell the American public about their religious observances and the Islamic faith in general. Among the activities are open houses at Islamic centers and local mosques. Other activities include public talks during Ramadan and iftar dinners with non-Muslims. At this time of year, some television stations broadcast advertisements that bring attention to Muslims as an important part of United States society. Shakir El-Sayed said his Islamic Center invites Christians and Jewish Americans to iftar dinner every Wednesday. The dinners are an effort to increase contacts between religious groups. Discussion about religion is popular during Ramadan. Keith Ellison is the first Muslim American to be elected to the U.S. Congress. He says these dialogues help build understanding between religious groups.
It's a critically important dialogue for us to have. All people of all colors, all cultures, and all faiths need to come together to talk about points of difference so we can discover how we are unified.
Since the early 1990s, U.S. presidents have given Ramadan greetings to the more than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide. Shakir said he believes the presidential greetings have helped Americans know more about Ramadan and Muslim Americans. I'm Mario Ritter.
A new report says a United States government program for foreign students has been expanding in recent years. The government's Optional Practical Training, or OPT, program was set up to help foreign students graduating from American colleges and universities. It gives them a chance to stay in the country for temporary employment after they complete their studies. The report is from the Washington-based Pew Research Center. It notes that many foreign students take classes in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. These four subjects are known by a single term, STEM. The center noted that under OPT, the number of foreign students graduating and working in STEM fields rose 400% between 2008 and 2016. The federal program enables F1 visa holders who complete school to remain in the United States and work for up to 1 year. 2 years ago, the program began permitting graduates in STEM fields to work an additional 24 months. In 2016, about 172,000 foreign nationals got a job through OPT. The program had 45,000 students in 2008 and 73,000 in 2014. The numbers are based on information provided to Pew by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, through a Freedom of Information Act request. More than half of foreign graduates in the program specialized in STEM fields.
From 2004 to 2016, About 74% of OPT approvals were citizens of Asian countries, the Pew study found. Students from India, China, and South Korea made up 57% of the total. Graduates from Europe were the second largest group, with an 8% total. Another 8% were from Latin America and the Caribbean, while 5% were from Africa. The optional practical training program is not as well known as the U.S. government's H-1B visa program, but the number of people taking part in OPT is much larger. Under the H-1B program, foreign workers are permitted to stay in the U.S. for up to 6 years. After this time, H-1B visa holders must either return to their home country or seek permission to stay permanently. Working a temporary job through OPT is seen as a first step for many people hoping to receive an H-1B visa at a later date. The H-1B program is designed to employ foreign workers in jobs requiring specialized knowledge, according to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Many of these jobs are filled by people with STEM backgrounds. Pew Research Center reports that in 2016, about 257,000 people took part in the OPT program. By comparison, the H-1B program is limited to a total of 85,000 people per year.
Pew noted that one reason for the rise in OPT numbers is because the number of new students on F-1 visas at U.S. colleges went up 104% from 2008 to 2016. The United States has the largest foreign student population in the world. Neil Ruiz, a co-author of the report, says the OPT program has been an important tool in getting foreign students to attend U.S. schools and keep them here after they graduate. But foreign student enrollment at U.S. colleges is reported to have dropped since the presidential election in 2016. Last November, the Institute of International Education released results of a study involving nearly 500 colleges and universities. They were asked to provide enrollment numbers for the 2017-2018 school year. On average, the results found a 7% drop in the number of newly enrolled foreign students at U.S. schools. The Institute says the drop is likely a result of government policies that seek to limit immigration and restrict travel from some mostly Muslim countries. In addition, the group says American colleges also are facing increasing competition from countries like Canada, Australia, and Britain. The U.S. government has also considered making changes to the H-1B and F-1 visa programs. Officials have said the changes would aim to prevent foreign nationals from taking jobs away from American workers.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has announced plans to carry out comprehensive reform of practical training programs in an effort to reduce fraud and abuse. The Association of International Educators estimated the economic effects of more than 1 million international students in the U.S. Its study found that the students added about $37 billion to the U.S. economy and supported 450,000 jobs during the 2016-2017 school year. The association's director, Esther Brimmer, said that it is important to realize there is increasing global competition for international student talent. She urged U.S. officials to strengthen policies that center on our nation's founding ideals of inclusivity and opportunity. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
And now we present The Making of a Nation. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States in 1901. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. To do this, he wanted a strong Navy. And he wanted a way for the Navy to sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Roosevelt decided to build that waterway. Today, Ashley and I tell the story of the Panama Canal.
For many years, people had dreamed of building a canal across Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The most likely place was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was to the north, Nicaragua. President Roosevelt appointed a committee to decide which place would be better. Engineers said it would cost less to complete a canal that had been started in the 1880s in Panama. But the United States would have to buy the land and building rights from a French company. The price was high, more than $100 million. So the committee decided it would be less costly overall to build a canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval.
The House of Representatives quickly passed a bill to build the Nicaragua Canal. Then the French company reduced its price for the land and building rights in Panama. It decided some money was better than no money at all. President Roosevelt was pleased. He gave his support to the Panama Plan. When the Senate began debate, however, it appeared the Nicaragua plan would win. Then, a volcano exploded in the Caribbean area. A city was destroyed. 30,000 people were killed. Soon, reports said another volcano had become active and was threatening a town. The volcano was in Nicaragua. Nicaragua's president denied there were any active volcanoes in his country. But one of Nicaragua's postal stamps showed a picture of an exploding volcano. That little stamp weakened support for the Nicaragua Canal. The Senate passed a bill for a Panama Canal instead. The House of Representatives changed its earlier decision. It approved the Senate bill.
At that time, Panama was a state of Colombia. Canal negotiations between America and Colombia did not go smoothly. After 9 months, the United States threatened to end the talks and begin negotiations with Nicaragua. The threat worked. In January 1903, Colombia signed a treaty to permit the United States to build the Panama Canal. The treaty gave the United States a canal zone. This was a piece of land 10 kilometers wide across Panama. The United States could use the canal zone for 100 years. In exchange, it would pay Colombia $10 million, plus $250,000 a year. The United States Senate passed the treaty within 2 months. The Colombian Senate rejected it. The Colombian government demanded more money.
President Roosevelt was furious. He saw the issue in terms of world politics, not simply Colombia's sovereignty. He said, "I do not think Colombia should be permitted to bar permanently one of the future highways of civilization." Roosevelt was ready to take over Panama to build the canal. That was not necessary. A revolt was being planned in Panama to gain independence from Colombia. The United States made no promises to support the rebels, but it wanted the rebels to succeed. Under an old treaty, Colombia had given the United States the right to prevent interference with travel across Panama. Now the United States used the old treaty to prevent interference from Colombian troops. Several American warships were sent to Panama.
The local leader of the Panamanian revolt was Manuel Amador. Amador had the support of the French company that still owned the rights to build the Panama Canal. The chief representative of the company was Philippe Bunau Varilla. He worked closely with an American lawyer, William Cromwell. Bunau Varilla and Cromwell provided Manuel Amador with a Declaration of Independence, a constitution, and money. Amador used the money to buy the support of the Colombian military commander in Panama City, the capital. He also got the support of the governor, who agreed to let himself be arrested on the day of the revolt. Amador formed a small army of railroad workers and firefighters. The rebel army planned to take over Panama City on November 4th, 1903. Just before that, 500 Colombian soldiers landed at Colón, 80 kilometers away. The soldiers could not get to Panama City, however. All but one railroad car had been moved to the capital.
Manuel Amador gave a signal. The revolution began. There was a little shooting, but no one was hurt. Most of the shots were fired into the air to celebrate the call for Panama's independence. Colombian officials were arrested quickly. Then Amador made a speech. He said, "Yesterday we were slaves of Colombia. Today, we are free. President Theodore Roosevelt has kept his word. Long live the Republic of Panama. Long live President Roosevelt. Colombia asked the United States to help it regain control of Panama. The United States refused. It said it would oppose any attempt by Colombia to send more forces there. The United States also recognized Panama's independence. And almost immediately, it started negotiations with the new government on a canal treaty.
The two sides reached agreement quickly. The treaty was almost the same as the one the Colombian Senate had rejected earlier. This time, however, the canal zone would be 16 kilometers wide instead of 10. And the United States would get permanent control of the canal zone. The treaty was signed on November 18, 1903. That was just 15 days after Panama declared its independence.
Colombia protested. It said the United States had acted illegally in Panama. Many American citizens protested too. They called President Roosevelt a pirate. They said he had acted shamefully. Some members of Congress questioned the administration's deal with the French Canal Company in Panama. Several investigations examined the deal. Theodore Roosevelt did not care. He was proud of his success in getting the canal started. He said, "I took the canal zone and let Congress debate. And while the debate goes on, so does work on the canal."
It took 10 years for the United States to complete the Panama Canal. The first ship passed through it in August 1914. In that same year, the United States signed an agreement with Colombia. The agreement expressed America's regret for its part in the Panamanian Revolution, and it provided a payment of $25 million to Colombia. Theodore Roosevelt was no longer president when the agreement was signed, but he still had many friends in the Senate. He got them to reject it. After Roosevelt's death, the United States signed another agreement with Colombia. The new agreement included the payment of $25 million. It did not include the statement of regret. The Senate approved the new agreement.
The issue of America's involvement in Panama caused much bitterness in other countries of Latin America. Some did not feel safe from American interference. President Roosevelt said the United States would not interfere with any nation that kept order and paid what it owed. Roosevelt was worried because some Latin American countries were having difficulty repaying loans from European banks. He did not want the issue of non-payment used as an excuse for European countries to seize new territory in the Western Hemisphere. Roosevelt said the United States was responsible for making sure the debts were paid. His policy led to further United States involvement in Latin America. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.